You're about to join Niels Kostrup Larsen on a raw and honest journey into the world of systematic investing and learn about the most dependable and consistent yet often overlooked investment strategy. Welcome to the Systematic Investor Series.
Welcome and welcome back to this week's edition of the Systematic Investor Series with Harry Christensen and I, Niels Kostrup Larsen, where each week we take the pulse of the global markets through the lens of a rules-based investor. Harry, it is wonderful to have you back on the show. It's been a while since we last had you on. How are you doing?
I've missed you, Niels. Let me start with that. And I'm very happy to be back, and I'm sure we'll have lots to discuss, so...
Absolutely. Now, we are going to be talking about a slightly different topic, I think, this week, courtesy of you, and mainly because you've had a real deep dive into a different asset class compared to what most people will know you for, namely volatility. But before we dive into all of that, what I always am curious about is kind of what you're keeping an eye on at the moment, not related to what we're going to be talking about today, but what you find interesting going on in the world, in the markets right now.
Somewhat surprisingly, I've been very interested in zero-day to expiration options recently. People used to contact me about them because I'd written quite extensively about weekly options in the Second Leg Down book that I wrote in 2017. But then I kind of lost interest because the prices of the stuff that I was buying for protection seemed to be going up, at least in equity land. And the good reasons for that, a lot of portfolio managers who trade volatility as an asset class, you know, who do relative value trades and so on, have strict limits that they have to adhere to at the end of the day. And these zero-day to expiration tools were great for blocking out risk. And what I started to see, and I'm sure many others know this, is a strangely shaped term structure of volatility where very short-dated protection was quite expensive. And then there was a quick dip down as you went 2 or 3 days out, and then everything normalized. So there was a strange spike at the short end. And so what I've seen recently is a proliferation of articles and blog posts and so on about selling these zero-day to expiration options, especially in equity land. And that has been a very good strategy since 2022. But a lot of the data is restricted. It only goes back 2 or 3 years. You can try to interpolate the surface before then, but the dynamics were different. And so I've seen a lot of press recently about how these are the greatest things in the world to sell, selling straddles every day on zero TT. I would be worried about this because as soon as this sort of idea catches fire or wildfire, there tend to be distortions in the market. And I've tested this stuff as well. It does look very attractive over the past 2 or 3 years. You can generate a Sharpe ratio well over 1 or 1.5 doing this. But we haven't seen a major event or a major volatility spike in equity land or in equity index land since 2022. I know 2022 was a fairly bad year for international stocks, but or international indices, but it wasn't a very volatile year. So I see something brewing in the horizon in zero DTE land. I'm just curious to see what happens.
It's kind of interesting you chose that topic. I did not expect you to pick volatility.
I didn't give you any advance warning.
But it's funny because I had written down that I wanted to ask you about volatility because I've had so many conversations with our mutual friend Jim about things and some of the things that he's seeing. And actually, he thinks, generally speaking, and he was mentioning this on our last week, I think, when we did our conversation, that he has a little bit of fear about what's happening right these days, sort of May 1st through whatever, 5th or whatever it was. He thought that was a pretty important time. But in any event, you chose volatility and you chose something that, you know, is interesting and sort of the changes that, you know, the zero-day options have had on the volatility space, I imagine so.
Well, the open interest has soared at the very short end. And I used to call these things gamma plucks. You could fill the holes in your portfolio by buying these things at fixed cost and blocking out extreme downside scenarios for a short time. So they were great, but maybe the pendulum has swung a bit too far.
It's funny, we argue so much on this podcast about the importance of being long-term, and a lot of these popular strategies, be it zero-day options and meme stocks and all that, is so focused on the short-term. But anyways, another thing that actually is kind of interesting this week from my perspective that certainly caught my radar was some of the statements coming out of the Fed this week. I think they're finding it very difficult to navigate this narrow path between, you know, wanting to give markets hope about rate cuts, but running into a brick wall where every time the inflation number comes out. And, you know, I think he came out saying this week that, you know, it's not likely to be a rate hike. The next move from the central bank is unlikely to be a rate hike. And it just feels like they're putting themselves a little bit into a corner like they did with this transitory narrative where they kind of already decided what they wanted to do and not actually looking at what the data was showing them, even though they say, of course, that they are data driven. And then he got this question, I think, as well, about stagflation. And Powell pointed out that by some measures, at least, the economy is growing at least 3% and inflation is below 3%. So he didn't see stag nor flation anywhere. So,
well, didn't Janet Yellen say something about how inflation was quite moderate, except for a collection of prices that were immoderately going up?
Yeah. And so, we'll still probably exclude from the calculations at some point. Anyways, we're just starting out the month of May. That means April just came to an end. So I thought I would just sort of summarize a little bit the month of April, which despite offering intervention in the Japanese yen, also a pretty meaningful sell-off in the last few days in cocoa, which has been a great trend for trend followers, and some meaningful weakness in equities, trend following models are still positioned kind of risk on when you look at the signals we have on at the moment. And that's obviously as we head into the summer months, where sometimes we do see some decent moves. Although April may also have been a month where some trend followers took a little bit of risk off the table, given some of these reversals. And of course, it is interesting that all of this is happening at the same time as we are seeing these dynamic shifts in the US economy, marked by, of course, the robust employment numbers we're getting, persistent inflation, and, as I mentioned before, this evolving Fed policy that we are witnessing every time there's someone speaking from the Fed. Now, the other thing that's happening at the moment, of course, which is interesting from a trend following perspective, is this divergence in central bank policy. We haven't seen that for a long, long time. It started a little while ago, but it's becoming clearer and clearer. Maybe even the ECB will do something different next month compared to the Fed. But it is giving some interesting opportunities in sectors that we haven't seen moving for a while, which is currencies. And I think trend followers benefited from that as well, certainly from the yen, but also Mexican peso, and I'm sure a lot of other things. But in any event, at the end of April, my trend barometer finished at 45, which is a neutral level. And I think that's probably fair enough. I expect a lot of managers will come in plus minus 2 or 3%, maybe more of them on the plus side for the month of April. Certainly when I look at the initial indications, the beta 50 finished, or is looking to finish at up 1.65% for the month, up 11.14% for the year. SocGen CT index up 1.82% for the month, up 11.65% for the year. The trend index doing well, up 1.65% for the month of April, up 14% and change for the year. And the winner this month was the short-term traders index. They enjoyed some of that volatility, up 2.4%, which is great for them, up 3.73% for the year. And that, of course, comes in light of the fact that traditional markets were down, MSCI World down 3.85%, still up 4.25% for the year. World government bonds down another 1.77% in April, and the S&P 500 Total Return Index up 4.08% and up 6.04% for the year. So interesting times. I know we're not going to be talking about trend following, but I know you follow trend following. You have a...
No pun intended.
You have a hidden trend follower in you, Harry. Exactly.
Waiting to come out.
Exactly.
Itching to come out.
Itching to come out. Any thoughts on that space, actually, since we haven't spoken for a while? Any?
Well, we did offline. We talked about Coco. And Coco was a phenomenal market in so many ways. One is that it had had long periods where it hadn't trended.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So I'm quite sure that some trend followers didn't even put it in their basket. It's not particularly liquid. I mean, it's not as liquid as many other commodity markets, such as oil. The other thing is that when looking at the commitment of traders report, which is always a mysterious thing to try and interpret, Coco seemed to be one of the markets where managed money was as large in terms of open interest as commercial hedging activity was, both for producers and users. That's quite unusual. And that suggests to me that there was a major piling into that trade on the trend following side, because managed money typically correlates to trend in most markets. So I presume it was to a very large extent, a technical affair once the poor production numbers came out from Africa. But that all has changed abruptly, as you well know, in the past week or two, let's say 2 weeks, partly as a function of higher risk requirements or margin requirements set by exchanges. One can debate to what extent this is a factor, because if you have a trade that's heavily onside, you're not desperate to get out too quickly, but it's a good topic for today.
Yeah. I mean, so Coco is interesting. Firstly, I don't follow the commitments of Traders Report, but I will say, from a trend following perspective, I think it is important to say that we, and I speak for the longer term trend followers, I guess, here, we were not buying it, much past second half of last year. I mean, all the interest signals really started in January 2023. And depending on your time scale, it takes a little while to get into a full position. But I don't think the trend followers, interestingly enough, really had much to do with Coco once it became a parabolic trade. You know, I saw and I commented on that with one of the other co-hosts, and I can't remember who it was, that recently there was an article out that one of these big oil traders, and I forget his name, but he's quite famous, I think, were getting into Coco suddenly this year, and it had gone up 60% alone in March and all of that good stuff. So I think personally that it is participants, certainly speculators, that have certainly moved the markets higher in the very end, but I just don't think it's trend followers, frankly. And as I also have commented on, trend followers in general who uses dynamic position sizing will have been selling Coco all of this year because of the increased volatility. So in fact, we've been going the opposite, in the opposite direction in 2024. But these are sort of more technical points, and I'm sure the headlines will say differently once it gets to the press.
Well, that bears itself out in the commitment of traders report as well. You see a lower number of contracts on the long side for managed money this year.
But if another hedge fund bought those contracts, you wouldn't see it, right? Am I correct in that?
You wouldn't. They would be blurred. Yes. It would be blurred.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Anyways, all right. Thanks for the little Coco introduction, because I know you knew I was going to bring that up, I'm sure, because we are moving into the world of commodities. I will also say that in addition to this margin requirement going up, and maybe that's the cause of this 35% plunge in Coco for the last 2 weeks, there was also news out that Nigeria actually is going to come out with a better harvest. So maybe that also had that good news had something to do with it. We'll see. Before we dive into your topics, and I've already revealed now, we're going to be talking about commodities, which is not a topic you and I normally talk about. The interest in commodities, how did that show up in your life? Because it's a little bit different than volatility, I imagine.
Well, just to go on the record, I have not stopped with long volatility. That's still a big part of what I do. It's a big part of my knowledge base, hopefully. It's just that that's a highly cyclical business in terms of interest. When things are going very bad, I tend to get tons of requests and a lot more business opportunities flow in. But there are long stagnant periods where it's hard to raise money, frankly. I know as a trend follower, if I were a trend follower, I would be well aware of the cyclicality of interest in the area. And the same is true here. So I was interested in commodities because just from a political standpoint or as an outsider, but I started examining some things that I knew and I wondered if I could re-engineer them. So the first thing was an analogy that I had, which is that the VIX and natural gas or electricity are quite similar. It's hard to replicate the VIX. It's very hard to store natural gas unless you liquefy it. Electricity is even worse. So now you have these commodities which have futures term structures and options dynamics, which look very similar to stuff that I know. So you get severe contango in the term structure where the front month trades at a significant discount to the further out months. You get low prices and heavy roll down. So longer term trend followers, let's say, are typically short most of the time these markets. And then you get sporadic mega spikes when there are supply shortages in the case of commodities or sort of risk off mega events in the case of the VIX. So the same sort of structures seem to apply. And so I put all of this stuff into my backtesting engine and I found that the same sorts of trades seem to be working. And then I compared that to other commodities markets, which actually behaved like the S&P. And I'll give you some examples there. For the S&P, at least in my opinion, somewhat out of the money puts, so somewhat out of the money insurances tends to be expensive. So let's say 3 month to maturity, S&P puts that are 10% out of the money tend to be quite pricey because institutions like to buy them. Whether it's the well-known and well-broadcasted products that the banks sell, the collared equity index products, or it's simply the mindset of institutions that want to hedge against moderate downside scenarios, those things tend to be rich. And so you can build a lot of hedging strategies around selling those and buying a lot of other stuff, whether it's at the money, far out of the money, or whatever. In the same way, I found that in the commodities market, such as oil or corn, soybeans, and so on, out of the money call options, which are trading on the other side of the distribution, tend to be expensive. And so that led me into a 9 month rabbit hole of trying to figure out why, and then constructing trades that would allow me to monetize increases in commodity prices, especially from a low level.
So over the years, we've had a number of commodity specialists on the podcast. And I'm not even including Sean Hackett that you spoke to because I can't remember exactly what he said. But some of the other ones have certainly been of this opinion that we're heading into this commodity super cycle, bull market. So why don't we start with that?
Yes. Well, there are many good reasons to believe that commodity prices will go up in the medium term. And I'll give a few. One of them is political. We're going into an environment where deglobalization seems to be coming into vogue, where countries are worried about food security, about energy security, about being able to produce what they need internally. Now, this requires more infrastructure, and it also, you know, to increase agricultural production internally requires more infrastructure, but it also creates frictions in the global trade for commodities, which could put upward pressure on prices. Moving along, we can go into the Green Revolution, which as it progresses at whatever pace, will require large amounts of industrial metals such as copper. You need a lot of copper to rebuild the grid. We're also in an environment where weather volatility seems to be picking up. Now, I'm not going to take a strong political stance here, but there have been greater extremes in temperature and precipitation in areas like Brazil, as the rainforest has been cut down significantly to increase agricultural production that do seem to have destabilizing effects, at least on the prices of certain grains and other commodities in the long term, or in the medium to long term. So we're kind of in an environment where the ease of transporting commodities across national borders is decreasing, where countries are trying to, God forbid, remilitarize, which requires a lot more metal and energy inputs, requires a lot more of those. And we also have an environment where weather could become more volatile going forward, which will lead to greater volatility in prices. And
okay, so I'm going to interrupt you again here just with a question. So I remember very clearly that after the Russian-Ukrainian conflict broke out, and we did see a lot of commodities spike higher, those were the exact reasons that the people would say, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. But to many people's surprise, actually...
They came right back down.
They came, they've been selling off for 2 years. So I know it's, you know, as a general case, some commodities are cheap and so on and so forth, and therefore they could go into a bull market. But is there anything that you've noticed in your research that kind of says, yeah, there's a reason why it didn't happen 2 years ago, but now things are different, even though they're not really different, because the same problems, you know, are here today than they were maybe a couple of years ago.
Again, I don't want to go too heavily into geopolitics, but I think if you go back over time, in World War I and World War II, the price of wheat trebled. It went up 3 to 4 times in each case. And these were sustained movements. I do accept the technology and sort of the improved supply chains from 50 years ago or 75 years ago are creating a bit of a downward pressure on grains, at least at the for the time being. But being able to own stuff that's cheap seems to be immensely valuable. And it's a really interesting topic for me, because in the same way that hedging is an attempt to provide the biggest payout you can given an equity market decline, a severe equity market decline, with the lowest cost of carry, buying depressed commodities, if you believe in the commodities bull market story, is a question of being able to buy in the using financial instruments, being able to buy and hold, in other words, virtually warehouse cheap commodities with low bleed, but with significant participation should prices rise.
So let's imagine I buy into that. And I don't know if you're thinking about specific commodities or all commodities, but, you know, as you rightly indicate, a lot of investors can't just buy the stuff and put it in a warehouse. So how do someone like you, me, a lot of the people listening to our podcast today, how would we go about thinking about this differently from what you've put together?
Yeah, that's an excellent lead-in. So if I were a physical supplier or a physical storage operator, I think the cost of storing and warehousing a cheap commodity actually goes down a bit as the price goes down. My insurance costs go down, my depreciation costs go down a little bit. Also, there's less incentive for me, let's say if I'm a farmer and corn's at $3, to sell corn into the market to pay off my loan, because I don't get as many dollars out of that transaction as when corn is at $6. So I do get paid a bit more implicitly to wait.
So, sorry to interrupt you again, Harry, because I'm really curious to understand. This is a little bit outside my normal expertise. We saw a couple of years ago that prices moved down in oil. They actually went negative. But that was not a time where storage became cheaper, so to speak. I guess it went down because of storage cost. Or so is this what you just mentioned? Is that sort of generalized, or where does the differences lie in terms of that? You know, at some point...
Let me make a less bold claim, just okay, to make my point clearer. Yeah. Let's say that I were in the steel business and the price of steel went down. I would go out and buy some scrap and then stick it in a warehouse somewhere and wait for the price to go up. The cost of my renting that warehouse space is insensitive in dollar terms to the price of steel. So I'm not paying more to hold steel in the warehouse when it's trading at a low price than when it's trading at a high price. By contrast, if I were to go into the futures markets and buy hot roll coil steel futures or any commodity futures, on average, the cost of buying and rolling a long position goes up quite dramatically as the price goes down. And that's a function of curve effects. And so my goal in this endeavor was to demonstrate that it could be done, or, well, what's it? That it would be possible to manage the costs of virtually warehousing a position using listed financial instruments by combining cleverly chosen futures and options to manage the carry. And I'm happy to give you kind of the back of the envelope description of that. So in the hedging world for long-dated options, you can sometimes pay for time decay using forward curve dynamics. I'll give you an example. Let's say that this isn't the case now, but let's say that interest rates were lower than the dividend yield for the S&P 500. If the forward curve roll, so if nothing happens and you're at a point on the term structure and you roll down the curve, that roll down can pay for the cost of holding an option from one day to the next. So you can pay for theta with rho. So strike out the example, just think of it in those terms. In the virtual warehousing world, the problem is similar, but almost the other way around. You pay for roll down with theta. And there are structural imbalances in the commodities world that are extremely interesting, and I'd like to go into them. And some of them may seem a bit strange to a trend follower, but I'll try and explain them. And I'll start with core. It seems to me, based on the detailed research that we've done, that when corn prices rise, producers meaning farmers and storage operators, elevator operators, are highly incentivized to sell futures to lock in gains. So as the price goes up, these commercial hedgers tend to be net sellers of futures. Same is true in copper and many other markets. So they're not thinking about capturing the right tail or even a significant amount of the right side of the distribution the way we long vol guys do or you trend followers do. They want to stay in business. They want to make sure that they can pay their employees, they can buy new equipment, keep the ball rolling, so to speak. So you see a strong tendency for that to occur, which leads to the stylized fact that most uptrends do not accelerate in markets where commercial hedgers are selling into rallies. So the moderate trends don't go ballistic most of the time. So what that implies in the option space is that somewhat out of the money call options, which are providing insurance against moderate outcomes, moderate increases tend to be overpriced. And you can demonstrate that using backtesting or more sophisticated statistical analysis, generally backtesting. And so being a seller of these moderately out of the money options can be very profitable if you can buy other options around it. So things like buying at the money calls, overselling out of the money calls, and then hedging the extreme can be a very attractive strategy from a P&L standpoint and from a time decay management standpoint that allows you to pay for some of the carry costs in buying the futures. So the virtual warehousing idea is basically a combination of buying futures, targeting cheaper points on the curve to manage roll costs, and then paying for those roll costs by identifying structural imbalances in the options markets that create both attractive time decay properties with bounded risk, but also capture some edge in such a way that the cost of holding a position in a flat market for the underlying commodity is virtually zero. And that's a big mouthful that I've said. There are a number of reasons why out-of-the-money options are expensive, but extremely out-of-the-money options are not. But we can dig a little deeper as you... process this for the listeners.
Yes. It sounds to me, and I could be completely wrong here, of course, it sounds to me that it's a little bit of a combination of convergent and divergent type components. How do you balance that profile? And do you... I shouldn't assume anything here because I'm really out of my depth here since it's brand new stuff. Do you want to end up being more divergent than convergent? Let's phrase it like that. Yes.
Yes. And to be fair, the warehousing works well in conjunction with trend following.
That's what I get the
idea
sense
is
of,
that
yeah.
If I wanted to buy Nat gas and it were cheap, which it currently is as of this, at least Henry Hub natural gas is quite cheap, I would want to be a virtual warehouser in the early stages because I don't want to be short. A trend follower would be short. If the client or if I believe the gas is going to go higher in the long term, but I don't know when, and I don't want to be eaten alive by roll costs along the way, I would be a blend of convergent and divergent strategies. Divergent in the futures, hybrid convergent, divergent in the options piece, until the price did go up significantly, at which point I would turn into more of a trend follower. And there are two reasons for turning into a trend follower. The first reason is I want to be able to capture as much of the upside as I can. But the other thing, as your listeners well know, is that trend following has the marvelous quality of having a risk control mechanism built into it. So I can hold that trend as long as it goes up and doesn't break, at which point I get out. So my goal is to capture the early stages of a rally where the skewness is most attractive. I mean, that's one of the advantages of the warehousing idea. If gas is at $1.50, the risk of it's going down a dollar are far lower than the odds of it's going up by an equivalent amount. Whereas if it's at 6 or 7, the risk becomes more symmetric. So I capture the asymmetry at low cost or perhaps even zero cost in the early stages of a rally. But then in order to get the full extent of the move, I want to convert myself into being a trend follower.
So I'm sure we're going to go back in some of these details because it's there's a lot of things you're mentioning here. But if I was going to be devil's advocate a little bit here, I would say it sounds like you want to be a value investor when it's good to be a value investor and a trend follower when it's good to be a trend follower. And then that actually means that timing is very important. I'm not so sure that that is important, really. I'm just saying that that's what it sounds like, so to speak, choosing to be the right type of investor at the right time. So how do we, and you're rightly in saying that there is definitely some weaknesses with trend following, but I'm sure there are, it's not all upside approaching it the way you do. So where do you see where are some of the main challenges in trying to do what you do now? Because you would think somewhere there's a cost to be paid. It's almost too good to say, well...
There's always a cost exactly. in any option structure.
Yeah.
As a rule of thumb, the way that this system seems to be working, this virtual storage operation seems to be working, is that if the price of a commodity is low and it drops further, I'll lose about 25% of the down move. If the price rallies, I'll capture about 2/3 of the upside. If the price goes skyrockets in a day, I'll only capture about 50% of the upside. So a mega spike from a low level, I'm not making all the money on the upside, and I am exposing the investor to a fraction of the downside. But if the investor believes that the market is already low, flatlining is not an issue. So if the spot price flatlines, the futures will typically drift down, but I won't drift down. I'll be flatlining. So there are certain things that are certain scenarios which aren't ideal for the strategy, but moderate increases are great. Spikes are okay. Big drops will incur losses, but a fraction of the loss. And I can keep playing the game and rolling from 1 month to the next if nothing happens. So I think it's a really interesting area. And the reason I'm so excited about it is because commodity options markets are driven by necessity as much as they are by arbitrage type ideas. And the arbitragers are great. I mean, there are some very famous names out there and very successful ones, but you don't know which side of the game they're going to be on at any given point in time. You don't know if they're making money on the short side, on the long side, on the relative value side. Maybe they can generate more alpha given their more intricate knowledge of the specifics of a given market. But what I'm trying to do is deliver that warehouse function at low cost and significant upside capture. And that's where I think the edge in this whole idea lies.
You know, you talk about virtual storage, but I was thinking while you were talking, from a marketing point of view, it's very popular to use cloud storage. So maybe it should be cloud storage of commodities. I don't know. Might help. It might steal that. No, but more on a serious note, again, we may dive into some of the more details, but I'm just asking questions as they pop into my head here. When you look at your backtest, because obviously you would have to rely on some kind of backtest to kind of get an idea of how this works. Have you found a couple of things? Have you found one that there is a big difference in how an approach like that will do, whether we are in actual a commodity bull market or not? And the other thing I was curious about is recently, as more of these exchange traded funds comes along, we see that in equity land, where obviously it's just flows that determines whether they're buyers or sellers. They don't really look at price. I don't know how many of them are really in pure commodities yet and how popular they are, how big they are. But obviously they haven't been around forever. So I'm curious to know whether having investors like that who are not so sensitive to price, if we can call it like that, and maybe in the nicest possible way, driven by stories, narrative, and perhaps not professional investors in terms of flows, does that also seem to have an impact on how the strategy react or have fared?
Well, so many good questions in there. I'll try and rattle off as many answers as I can. The first thing is that one of the encouraging thing about the backtests is that for all storable commodities, or for nearly all storable commodities, the same structures work. So there's a lot of cross-sectional stability in the analysis, which is very reassuring. And it suggests that end users of commodities are either more credit constrained or less sophisticated than producers. So in the oil markets, to give one example, airlines are major hedgers. Airlines are not that solvent some of the time. It's not been the greatest business to run. So they're not going to be doing complicated structures that have open-ended risk. They tend to buy call options as kind of a base case in their treasuries to hedge against a rip in the price of oil. So that there's that sort of imbalance that occurs in very many markets for slightly different reasons, and we've analyzed those too. What regimes are good in markets where the price is low, but the demand for out-of-the-money insurance is high? That's a good regime for me. There's a little bit more edge in that. Please remember, though, that I'm covering all the upside. I'm not just selling out-of-the-money options. I'm overbuying deep out-of-the-money options and buying at-the-money ones as well. So it's a bounded structure that gives upside participation, but low prices and high demand for hedges are attractive. Higher prices are a little bit less attractive on the call side. Things do normalize, but that's where the trend component really comes in handy. And it's the same idea as in the hedging world. So I've found analogies abounding, let's say. As a hedger, my idea is to buy volatility when it's cheap and then turn it into a trend follower if I have to provide protection on the way down once volatility has become rich. And the reason for that is volatility tends to be more cyclical than price. Prices tend to trend a lot more. And why would I want to overpay for insurance when I can get the same protection just by selling into the downside? Now, for equity indices, it's a bit more challenging, actually, because, as you know, the signal-to-noise ratio in bear markets tends to be lower than in bull markets, because declining markets for equities tend to be choppy, rallying markets can be a lot more stable. So there are issues in a pure momentum-based approach in a single market like the NASDAQ or the S&P, but that's the general theme. And the theme applies to the other side of the distribution, meaning for commodities, it applies to upside moves in the sense that the relative value plays tend to be more attractive in financing the cost of carrying a position when prices are low, but investors are worried about upside risk. And the attractiveness of some of these structures decreases as prices rise and the hedging has already occurred or is being monetized. So trend following again plays a role in this idea of regime-based participation, which is a big part of what I think about. It's always about regime-based participation for an options guy. Namely, in certain regimes, certain spreads or trades tend to work relatively well. In other regimes, they don't. And as soon as you put an options trade on, you've already decided what regime you're hoping for and what you don't want, because there's no structure that will do well in every case.
So in my world, we have a defined universe of markets. We apply the same risk to all markets. We don't know where the next big trend is going to be. How does that work in this world?
Sadly, it's more restricted what markets you can trade because the options liquidity is sharply decreasing once you go beyond the biggest 10 commodities markets, let's say. So cocoa would have been virtually unplayable using this strategy. And other small markets such as milling wheat, bean oil, all of those places that I would be curious to participate in are out of reach. Really, my universe is the biggest 15 options markets in the world. I think it is possible to expand into other markets with a better OTC, a better bank relationships for things like Nordic Power and French Power and so on. But in the listed world, I'd say it's the 10 biggest markets. And it's possible to move beyond that, but I haven't done so yet. So that's a work in progress. So that's already a restricted universe. So what I can say is that liquidity and the ability to store the commodity are two drivers in this whole thing. I don't plan to be providing virtual warehousing of weather derivatives because there's no physical analogy.
No.
And so I'm guided by that too.
So as we sort of start to wind down a little bit on this particular topic, Harry, talk a little bit about, I called it cloud storage, but let's talk about the virtual warehousing of these things. And the other thing I wanted to sort of maybe also ask you a little bit about, and that is the sort of the consistency of an approach like this, because we talk a lot about trend following, but we know trend following is not very consistent. It's in fact very unpredictable. So I'd love to hear also a little bit about that side of things when you approach markets like you've described. But let's go to the warehousing first.
Yeah, well, you've had people like Adam Rosenzweig on your show. Very well-known, long-term, bullish investors in the commodity space, and their horizons are extremely long. And they talk about things like uranium and various energies and so on, traditional energies being required over the next 10, 20, 30 years. So this is kind of an attempt to engineer their approach in markets other than the ones they are focused on. So you have various areas where you can get the equivalent of physical storage. Gold ETFs are a good example. There is some physical backing of those. Uranium is claimed to be physically backed, but one can argue as to whether there is any freely available open market in which to sell these claims or these units. So even that becomes a sketchy proposition. I know that Sprott has various ETFs in that space. And then you quickly dive down into the area of things like the Tucrium ETFs, which are blends of futures, and you've lost the virtual storage concept immediately. So I'm trying to fill that gap. So if someone watches Adam's podcast or Adam Rosenzweig's podcast or various other super cycle bulls in the commodity space. Hopefully this will resonate with them as a way to get positions in place at low prices. And whether they choose to do it themselves, whether they choose to allocate to someone or pick particular markets and build their own virtual silver mine or copper mine or have it built for them is up to the investor, obviously. But I think it's an intriguing idea because it does allow people to participate at low cost in markets where they have a strong view that there could be a significant long-term increase. This will not eliminate the volatility along the path. It will just allow them to sit tight, wait, and not bleed so much that their break-evens make the strategy untenable. So for example, at $3 a bushel, your break-even for corn has historically been $4 over a 12-month horizon. It costs a dollar to buy and roll the futures, at least from 2000 to the present. You don't want to have those sort of 30% break-evens over 1 year. If you can turn that into a 5% break-even, 10% break-even, you can wear a position far longer. And that allows you to express your view without having all the issues of running a physical business, which it frankly is untenable for most. So I think that's the point that I want to get across on the storage idea, even if it means that you visualize the real physical entity in your head, but you're getting delivered very similar returns, but without a lot of the logistical difficulties and headaches and barriers to entry.
You know, when you speak about these things, I get this picture in my mind where you see nowadays people growing different types of agriculture in big storage houses in layers of what, you know, it just looks so different to how we think about crops being grown, and here they're doing it indoor and all of that. So one question also that springs to mind, of course, the series we're on is called the Systematic Investor Series. And I was curious how much of this, because it sounds like a little bit of a complex strategy, how much can be systematized and how much do you have to rely on some kind of manual discretionary input?
Well, I'm sad to say that I manually execute trades, even in the hedging business. So the execution is manual. Sourcing liquidity is manual. But the structures that I put on are identical, conditional on the prevailing regime across all markets. So there's no thinking about, should I be buying a put or a put spread today? It's a standard structure that's done again and again and again, conditional on the regime. So all the backtesting, and it is backtesting to a large degree, so the viewership needs to be aware of that, but it is conditional as well. So the first thing is to come up with unconditional backtests across markets, see how stable the ideas are, identify the possible reasons for the mispricings in the structures that work, or the inefficiencies that make the structures work, but then to identify regimes, whether they're trend-based or volatility-based, that are particularly attractive for the strategists. So it is very systematic in terms of there being a template which maps a state of the world onto a trade. Of course, the trend piece is very systematic, but there is discretion in terms of legging up the trade, figuring out what the best time of day to do it in, and so forth. So there is a bit of manual intervention in that.
It's been very fascinating to hear about this, Harry. So I do appreciate you coming on and talking about this. As I said in the very beginning, this is very different for me to talk about. And so I am sure, absolutely sure, that there are things that I should have asked you that I haven't done. So I'm going to
give you...
give you a chance maybe to kind of set the record straight about some of the things I left out. As I said, it's a mouthful. It's an interesting way because I think investors, if we just boil it down, I think investors have become more used to thinking about other asset classes away from stocks and bonds. Obviously, we've spent the last 10 years trying to get trend following on the radar. and other people have tried to get commodities on the radar. And to some extent, of course, you know, we are successful in introducing new asset classes to portfolios. And I certainly feel from the beginning of my career, 35 years ago to now, there is a big plate of types of assets and strategies that are very accessible for many investors. We know that. You're taking it to a new level. You're sort of saying, okay, well, commodities are interesting, but we know there are challenges. So here's a way to look at it where we can mitigate, maybe not remove completely, but we can certainly mitigate some of those challenges. So why don't you sort of round things off maybe with a little bit of a...
Well, the way I think about it, I'm sure you, I hope you would agree, is that every strategy is trying to solve a problem that investors face. So for trend following, it's, I want to participate in large moves that may occur in many, many different markets that I typically don't have access to, whether they're up or down. What should I do? Well, allocate to a trend follower, or perhaps build your own system if you're able. For this, I'm trying to solve problems for two different types of investors. One are the types who have bought into this bull market super cycle thesis for commodities, realize that they don't have access to the physical commodity production or distribution setup, and want to be able to enter at cheap prices without having to pay too much to hold positions. So reducing timing risk, that's the goal. The other goal, which is quite interesting, is that for many people who actually are in the business, maybe they're in the oil services business and they're worried that the profitability of their business is really just a function of the oil price rather than being a function of how well they can run their business vis-a-vis someone else, that there's really one major driver. So maybe they want access that way, or maybe it's a mining company that realizes that it's going to take a while to increase production, but wants exposure in the meantime at low cost. So I'm trying to appeal to that crowd in terms of supplying commodity exposure in a timely and low-cost way for people who know that business, who know a specific business, and want that exposure in a liquid and easy-to-access manner, but also people who are very bullish on commodities and don't want that necessarily corrupted by, you know, the sensitivity of commodity shares to, say, the S&P 500, or the level of diversification of certain businesses that cloud the issue of whether they're really gaining exposure to what they want. So if I invest in a mega food company, I don't know if the positions are hedged or unhedged. I don't know whether they're going to shift from the commodity I'm interested in to a different commodity, and how they're going to play all of those games. I also don't know if passive flows or other dynamics are going to drive the prices of those shares more than perhaps the stuff I'm actually interested in investing in on the long side. So I view this as being a good complement to trend following. In fact, it incorporates trend following in the later stages. But it's particularly useful for people who have a view and they want the most efficient way to express that view in terms of up capture and low cost. So that's really the thesis that I'm trying to present.
And just to recap the sectors that this is possible in sort of applying it to?
As of now, copper, silver, gold, so those metals. Oil, and to a lesser extent, gas, because of its lack of storage. All the grains. And in principle, it can be applied to other markets as well. But as of now, it's 7 or 8 markets where the systems are up and running.
Fantastic. Good stuff. Very much appreciate that, Harry. Super interesting learning something new for sure. And to all of you out there listening, if you enjoy these type of conversations, please go to iTunes, Spotify, Amazon, wherever you get your podcast, and leave a rating and review. Next week, I'm joined by Nick, who is back from some traveling, for a fun, insightful conversation, no doubt. So make sure you send over your questions, and then I'll do my very best to Put them in front of him. Info@toptradersonblog.com is the usual email where you should send them. From Harry and me, thanks so much for listening. We look forward to being back with you next week. And in the meantime, as usual, take care of yourself and take care of each other.
Thanks for listening to the Systematic Investor podcast series. If you enjoy this series, go on over to iTunes and leave an honest rating and review. And be sure to listen to all the other episodes from Top Traders Unplugged. If you have questions about systematic investing, send us an email with the word question in the subject line to info@toptradersunplugged.com, and we'll try to get it on the show. And remember, all the discussion that we have about investment performance is about the past, and past performance does not guarantee or even infer anything about future performance. Also understand that there's a significant risk of financial loss with all investment strategies, and you need to request and understand the specific risks from the investment manager about their products before you make investment decisions. Thanks for spending some of your valuable time with us, and we'll see you on the next episode of The Systematic Investor.